Good morning, Brother John.
Good morning. So how's that weather shaking up in Austin, Texas?
Wow. We have an extraordinary day. We've had a pretty good week. It's cool at night. The air is crisp, northwest winds, and it's comfortable sleeping weather at night. And during the day, the sun comes out nice and hot, gets up in the 80s. Yeah, this is my perfect weather. I'm happy. How about you?
Well, it's pretty brisk here. It's sunny, about 42 degrees. Probably won't get into the 50s until after the weekend's all the way to sometime Monday. But the good news is it's clear, a lot of sun, and I did survive a day at the old ballpark yesterday at Wrigley with minimal symptoms from my cancer treatment,
right.
So which we'll, of course, get into a little bit later. So, hey, listen, I thought we'd start out by maybe talking a little bit about our T-shirt campaign,
then
I'll talk a little bit about some of the comments that we've gotten from listeners and shout-outs.
Yeah.
So, how are we doing here? How are we doing T-shirt wise? As I'm wearing.
Well, of course, I'm wearing mine too. Mary Jane's wearing hers. We all God's chillins got one of these T-shirts and they're wearing them. So I realize many people hearing this don't have one. You can now. All you have to do is you can go to our main site, which is thebro.show. .com or anything like that. Very simple URL. Just enter that in a browser and you'll get to our site that has all our podcasts and also has a call out for the shirt. Another way to get the shirt is just type shirt.thebro.show and it'll take you straight to where you can get a t-shirt. They're beautiful. We got a brand new design for those who have gotten previous versions. This is all new. It's a dark blue t-shirt. There's more color in this one. It's bright, it's vibrant, I think it's really good. I can't wait to get mine, so hope everybody out there gets theirs. So we got that going.
Sounds good. Okay, that's real good. A couple of shout-outs. Last week we talked a little bit about our favorite Chicago movies, and listener Kevin McGivney brought to my attention the fact that I cited the wrong high school in the movie I picked. I picked My Bodyguard as one of my favorites, which was shot very close to where I live. And it's briefly just a story about a young kid who comes into high school, kind of a small kid who's bullied, and he hires a bodyguard. Well, I cited a school very close called Lincoln Park High School,
right?
Which probably is where he should have gone since it's only 8 blocks away, but he stretched a little bit. And the actual school is the Lakeview High School, which is located in Wrigleyville, so near Wrigley Field. It's about 4,000 north. Wrigley's about 3,600 north. So I'm glad that Kevin was able to give me that correction. The other thing is I want to give an update on the fact that we talked about the St. Louis Blues and their march to get their first Stanley Cup. They're the oldest franchise in the NHL not to have a Stanley Cup. And listener Brett Bontani brought to my attention, he's a Blackhawk fan, that I need a little more dose of reality, that it's going to be a tough road for the Blues. And as it's turned out, the Blues are playing the Nashville Predators right now, and they're holding on by dear life. Last night they won, so they've basically fought off elimination. There are three games. They've 3-2. So the Blues have won 2, Predators 3. There'll be hopefully two more games. The Blues will have a tough one though, because they're not going to have to go on the road and play Nashville on Sunday.
Yeah.
So I appreciate Brett kind of trying to get my feet back on the ground, and it looks like that's that'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. It's going to be a tough road for the
go,
Blues.
Blues. Go Blues, go.
Yeah, go Blues, go. We're all interested in them, you know, succeeding.
Yep.
So,
I'll give a quick shout out to Nate McClure. Yeah. He's been listening to these, and he's an old classmate of mine and a friend of John's from Lindbergh High School. And he makes comments from time to time on some of the stuff we're talking about. I really kind of general comments. I really appreciate it, Nate. And yeah, that's it.
All good. Very good. Well, we're going to shake up things a little bit today. You know, our discussions are around the topics of sports, film, and fake news. But behind that, we, of course, are using this as a means by which we are able to deal with our loss and also with our cancer, right, which we both have. So we've done this once before where we talked about cancer, and it just seemed like it'd be the right opportunity for us to, first we talked a little bit about our previous podcast about the awareness, importance of getting checkups, and how you fit in talk mostly about prostate,
right,
cancer. Today, what we're going to talk a little bit about is we're going to be talking about the progress that's being made on cure and treatments. And this all piqued, my interest was piqued by the fact that I, about a week ago, read an article in USA Today. And that article, basically, if you can go just by the title of it, progress is not the same as cure for cancer. Well, both of us having cancer, obviously, it's, you know, these kind of things, articles kind of pique your interest. This isn't flipping the page in the newspaper.
Nope.
You kind of concentrate on this page a little bit. So I also thought, well, it'd be good for me to not just hang my hat on one article. So I read another one in the Scientific American entitled, Can We Truly Cure Cancer? And so both of us, since we have cancer, you know, these, like I said, these piqued our interest. I think what we'll do to start out with is kind of give what our status and our where we fit into with respect to cancer,
right,
what cancers we have, et cetera. And I'll start it, Jerry, and you can finish
sure.
up. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer stage 2 in July of last year. And then in August, I was diagnosed with stage 2 rectal cancer, keeping in mind that these are both separate, what they call synchronous cancer. In other words, I got two separate cancers. This isn't metastasis. So I was confronted with having both of those. And now we'll talk a little bit later about how things have progressed in terms of treatment, et cetera, as we, you know, relate to our
right.
experiences. Jerry, perhaps you can give a little bit about where what your situation
yeah, yeah.
is.
About November 15th, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer stage 4, which is similar but very different than the stage 2 and stage 1 that most people have and the stage 2 that John has. So my treatment options are much more narrow. They're limited. But we talked about that a good bit the last time, and we'll talk more as we go on here. But that's basically where I am yeah. on it. And the dealing with it.
So, yes, and that's what we'll be getting into. Overall, you know, what I'd like to do is to basically kind of give you the background as to what's going on in terms of cure and treatments.
Yep.
And by the way, neither of us are experts. We're just people
nope.
who are obviously very inquisitive as to cancer since we both have it and, you know, read a little bit more than the average person might. But hardly experts in the field. I feel it's important, though, that we can relate our experiences and how that fits into what's going on in terms of treatment and cure. So a lot of my information I got in terms of overall it's a pretty positive picture that we see. I use the National Cancer Institute as a source of most of my information, and it's an organization which I'll explain a little bit later as we take a look at sort of the business of cancer. But the bottom line is that the fatality rate, since its peak back in 1991 with respect to cancer, has dropped about 25%.
Wow, that's significant.
That is a very that's very good. And I also wanted to take a look and see, well, my sense is more people are getting cancer, which kind of, you know, you would think, well, that would go the other direction. But actually, recently what's happened is that we find that the good, healthy lifestyles and has allowed people, you know, such as not smoking, have kind of leveled off the incidence, so that although if we took a look at it in a much broader or longer term, we would, you know, we'd realize that cancer is, you know, more people are getting cancer because we're just basically living
right.
older. So, but I think that even that statistic has just shown a leveling off with perhaps a slight decrease in incidence in recent years. So we've got two very good factors. Another thing that one of the things is about cancer is prognosis, and prognosis is a tricky subject.
Yes,
and quite often you're given a cancer measure as to success is given by what's called the 5-year survival rate. In other words, what are your chances of living 5 years after being diagnosed with cancer? And you'll find that every, you know, it's a complicated thing. You've got different types of cancer. You've got different stages where you'll get these numbers cited. You know, they're interesting to look at, but don't hang your hat on them, I don't think. Because, you know, and quite often these are used to describe more aggressive forms
of
cancer.
Right, faster moving.
The faster moving stuff. And but the point is that there are just so many factors to look at. And I think that's the reason that my experience has been that doctors don't like to give you any very specific information in this regard, because there are so many factors that fit into the way that you, where you fit into that equation. And I mean, some are physical, such as health. Others are emotional, the way you approach your illness.
Yep.
So the fact is, and Jerry, perhaps you can give your thoughts in terms of how, you know, you feel about the five-year measure.
Yeah, well, you know, you go into this thing, and I was going into it on the heels of another disaster, so I was a little numb, to say the least. And when you're like that, you don't, you're kind of like out of your body, above the room that you and your doctor are in. You're not quite there, and you're kind of witnessing the whole thing. And so I wasn't as, you know, inquisitive and whatever as I could have been in the first days of all this. Yeah, I was just kind of overloaded and numb. But, you know, I do remember distinctly now how well Dr. Yang, my urologist, who's my main doctor on all this, handled it. And the one thing he said to me, see, I started asking a lot of questions, and, you know, he gets this look on his face, okay, here's another nerd that goes on the internet to try and figure this stuff out, right? And poor doctors, they deal with this. So anyways, he starts the look, and then he just kind of, you know, very nicely butts in a little bit and says, look, your cancer is your cancer. It's not like anybody else's cancer. We are going to work on your cancer. And that did it. That did it. So I stopped worrying about the 5-year. I stopped worrying about the statistics. I stopped looking up everything on the internet as much as I was getting a little obsessive. So it really calmed me down, and that focused me on the most important thing, which we'll talk about, is your attitude and your emotional state. And he knew he had to get me on track because I was already suffering from, you know, the death of my son 10 days before I was diagnosed. So he really handled me well, and hats off to the Yangster. He's great. We're going to have him on the show sooner or later.
I would say that I have a comparable. I think my approach with my doctors, and obviously I've twice as many, and I'm not trying to compare, you know, measure simply right when we're here, but I've got two cancers, so as a result, I got to deal with two different doctors, and I think both of them talked. They perhaps just to try to set you off on the right foot. They talk about, you know, we're gonna lick this. We have a plan. We can do it, and then specifically, as in your case, talk about the details as it relates to you,
right.
Rather than taking a look and trying to put you into a big population pool as to how it's going to work out. That's not the way to approach this. So we're going to talk a lot more about our own experiences, but just to kind of, again, give a little more background here, cancer is the second leading cause of death. It's very, very close to heart disease. They're like neck and neck, and I kind of use that term because today is the Kentucky Derby, so we can't forget that. And so within the cancer category, we have leading causes of cancer for women are lung, breast, colon, and rectal. While for men, we have lung, prostate, and colon. And
this
rectal.
Is U.S. stuff we're talking about.
U.S. stuff. And the fact is that here we are, and we find out that men are 40% more likely to get cancer than women. I mean, there's a reason these women live longer, and this is part of it. And we don't need to get any of the other details as to why they live longer.
Right.
But the fact is that so here we are. Jerry and myself, we've got two out of the three for men. We got prostate, and he's got prostate, and I've got both prostate and colon and rectal.
Right.
So as we take a look at the factors that have really caused cancer rate to drop, obviously, like I've mentioned already, the promotion of healthier lifestyles is a big piece of that. But the other thing is that earlier detection, both through better methods of discovery and more awareness of what you know should be, you know, it's at, you know, there's a lot of promotion out there. Cancer and other illnesses are, you know, broadcast on and we'll talk a little bit about the promotion or the advertising and the awareness and how important those campaigns are. I would just like to point out the fact that when it comes to detection, quite often you just don't realize it's not only that you detect a cancer, but you detect exactly where it's located.
Right.
Because back 20 years ago, as I told Jerry, my wife, who died of esophageal cancer, she died from the complications of esophageal cancer, which is much different.
Yep.
She was diagnosed with having lung cancer when just within days of starting treatment, they realized that she had esophageal cancer. So it's not only discovering the cancer, but discovering the right cancer, because what happened is they thought she had lung cancer because it had metastasized to her lung. So what we find out as I take a look at all this, looking at cure versus a treatment, is that the treatment is what we're going to kind of concentrate on. And there are better treatments, better administration of these treatments.
Yeah.
And here's another area where we kind of touched a lot of the bases. We've got surgery, which is an obvious one, but surgery goes way back, obviously. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the background as to when these things started.
Yeah, we have surgery, radiation, and chemo, are the big ones, aren't they?
Surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. But what's kind of interesting, though, is that you hear right now that these various treatments and chemotherapy has its origins back to the World War II.
Mustard gas,
And soon after, mustard gas. And soon after the war, you know, chemicals that were that are effective in treating cancer cells were discovered, as they figured out that we could have chemicals that could do that. And as I pointed out to Jerry, I have a way of wedging baseball into practically every topic.
Oh, really?
And Babe Ruth actually is, as much as he's noted for his baseball, if you talk to the medical profession, they consider him to be a pioneer in cancer treatment. Babe Ruth was one of the first people to actually get the use of an experimental drug, a chemotherapy. And another thing about Babe Ruth is, if you heard Babe Ruth towards the end of his life, he sounded so hoarse, everybody assumed he had throat cancer, when he actually had cancer of the nasal pharynx, which is the passageway between your mouth and your nose, and a very rare type of cancer. He was treated with chemotherapy in 1947 and showed remarkable recovery in a short period of time, where he was able to regain his appetite and some health. And that's the good news. The bad news is they didn't know enough to realize they needed to continue the chemotherapy longer.
Yeah.
So the success he showed resulted in them stopping it too soon.
Yep.
Now, the good news is that Babe was able to, because of his prolonging his life just a little bit, he was able to participate in his Babe Ruth Day, which happened in the season of 1948. And by August of 1948, he had passed away. So the bottom line, chemotherapy goes back into the 40s.
Yeah, I had no idea about that.
Take a look at radiation. Yeah, I mean, I just found out about it, probably about maybe 5-6 years ago. Radiation goes back to 1900.
Right.
It's been used to treat cancer. The bottom line, though, with radiation is that as they were learning it could be used to treat cancer, they also learned that it could be used to cause cancer.
Yeah.
So it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah,
there.
It's hard to target, careful, too. You could damage other stuff.
Yes, and that's part of where the improvement of the treatment has come. We've also got hormone therapy, which started back in the 1920s. It was discovered through castration, through the removal of male testicles. They found out that there was a dramatic regression in prostate cancer. And since then, what we find out is that they found drugs that could basically provide that same kind of effect. So that maybe you didn't have to necessarily go that drastic means by which to treat cancer. And the last one I'd like to mention is immunotherapy, one of the more recent treatments that we hear about, but it actually dates back fairly long too. Now, the problem This is one where it's been used more in clinical trial. And we're going to talk a little bit about a specific example of this is a very tricky discussion point. So bottom line is that as we take a look at, I think we've cited like one, two, three, we've cited five different ways of treating cancer, of which I've had three and you've had two. So, you know, as we look at our treatments and we kind of talk a little bit about our experiences, so perhaps, Jerry, you can talk a little bit about which of the treatments you've had and how they worked out in terms of, you know, your ability to you know, kind of...
function?
You know, stand up to them.
My situation is, like I said, different than John's or our brother Jeff, who also had prostate cancer about 10 years ago. So... So it was completely, and I was a little thrown off by it. The treatments I was getting and everything, because it wasn't like John and Jeff's treatments. And I kind of have a little bit of a reputation in our family for being a, I don't know what you call it, maverick kind of a guy, does things differently. And everyone thought, oh, God.
Marches to the beat of a different drummer.
Yeah, and I am a drummer. So,
yeah, that's right.
So, anyways,
you're the drummer. Yeah. I forgot.
Why not? So, anyways, I wasn't crazy or marching to a different beat. I was doing very standard treatments, and the only way you can treat it when it gets to stage four is, it does, of course, chemo does no good at all on this stuff because it moves too slow. And the whole point of chemo is to kill things that are moving fast. That's how it identifies the cancer. But so I didn't have that luxury. Secondly, then there's radiation. And I did have an option for radiation. I'll talk about that in a second. The surgery, out of the question, because it had spread and they'd never get it all. And it could make my health take a downturn. And that, you know, could help the cancer. So they just said, no, look, you really only have one option. And that's hormones. Oh, and, you know, when you say that, that's not actually what it is. It's hormone deprivation. So ADT means we're going to give you some drugs that are going to drastically reduce the amount of testosterone and therefore androgen, which is what prostate cancer just loves to snack on. We're going to get rid of those things. And so... you are in prostate, Mr. Prostate's just going to, as John said, radically take a back seat. But, yeah, so anyway, my treatment plan that I went with was a little different than what most people, and here I did, I guess, go to a beat of a different drummer, but in terms of U.S., most males take these shots and pills to deprive themselves of androgen, and that's fine if you're stage one or two because it's short term, right, John? You had these, as I recall.
Yeah. Right, I had the shots, and it's used as a means by which to kind of set you up. Whether you're going to do radiation, the more traditional, or you're going to use surgery to have the prostate removed, they like to stage it by reducing the size and containing the cancer before they actually go in and take continue on with another
the
treatment.
Stage four guys have a different scenario, you know. We're going to be long-term users of those drugs. So that means within a year or so, the testes are not going to be working at all and will never work again. So that's the reality. But you'll still have something hanging around down there and, you know, oh, okay, cool. You know, and that's what most people do. I did not do that just because I looked at the side effects of the drugs. And what it meant was that my treatment would have to involve lots of other stuff that was also potentially had side effects. There's a multiple side effects thing that can go on when you take a lot of prescription drugs. So I didn't want to get into that. And I read up. Overseas, it's more common in England and in Europe for men to simply have their testicles removed. They have a nice little euphemism for them, an orchiotomy. They make it sound like it has something to do with orchids. it's not the same word. So anyways, they remove them. And at first I was going, wow, this is really drastic. But it turns out it's really kind of a complicated vasectomy. They do not like, you know, mafia style go in there and just slash and gash and, you know, et cetera. They actually are very precise about it. Two small incisions, pull the your backup singers out, snip them, and sew you up. And it takes almost no time at all. It took like an hour. And I was home. I was fine. That, you know, within hours. The only thing that kept me from going back quicker was they had to wait for the anesthesia to wear off and all that stuff, and you know, so I could function. And someone took care of me and all that stuff. So all fine, all good. And that turned out to be kind of a good thing because I avoided a lot of other stuff. While I was going through all this, I have a urologist and an oncologist. The oncologist was really gung-ho on me getting radiation treatments. And I was puzzled by this. Well, and he showed me a study. That's how they back this stuff up. They really do have an incredible treatment, radiation treatment for people with prostate cancer. And it turned out even people with stage four, their survival rate goes up a teeny bit. It's not really that much. But the cool thing about it is this is the best a radiation device I think I've ever heard of. I've never heard of any other doctors using it, and I've kind of checked around. It's not like unheard of. Obviously, other doctors use it. What it is, you get into this device, and every time you get a treatment, what it does is it does an MRI, so it can see exactly where the cancer is and where to target. Usually, and John will tell you this and other people, is usually when you get radiation treatments, they mark you with a pen, a Sharpie or something, and that's where they go in, and they have to count on you doing a whole bunch of stuff so your cancer doesn't move around. And if you've got prostate cancer, it's in a mobile area. So, you know, you eat too much or whatever, and you've got a problem, and you're not going to hit it. But these guys, they really do have that down. And they figured out the right dosage of radiation and all kinds of other stuff. So it really was a good option. But in the end, I decided not to because I didn't see the upside wasn't big enough to warrant the downside and also the financial impact. It's massively expensive.
Yeah, so, you're stage four, so your treatment was the hormone route.
Right.
Versus, well, what I had to do was, since my cancers, both of them were kind of a month apart in terms of detection and diagnosis, I was confronted first with stage two prostate, and with that, I was given the options of whether I go the radiation route or do I go the surgery route, and it was kind of a hem and haw between. My brother had done a specific form of radiation, which is called seeds, where they implant seeds within the prostate. And it's actually the radiation is over a period of time has helps get rid of the cancer.
It's in the seed, the radioactive seeds.
It's in radioactive seeds. And here my brother is
Jeff.
Probably 10 years out. Yes, my brother Jeff is 10 years out, and he did very well. So I was told that since my cancer, even though it was stage 2, was not a candidate for seeds because it's pretty pervasive within. It was spread around in my prostate rather than being more specific. So as I'm hemming and hawing whether to go the radiation route versus the surgery route, I then, all of a sudden, a month later, am confronted with the fact that I've got, and I'd already started the hormone treatment to reduce the size and contain my prostate cancer. I was confronted with the fact that I had rectal cancer. So at that point, you'd say, well, gee, this is going to become more complicated. But actually, my treatment options became simpler because I went to my the rectal surgeon. He says, you know what? I got an idea here I think we've done before and you might want to consider. And that is, and he says, look, well, we got the hood up and we're taking, because we have to use surgery for rectal cancer. Why don't we just take your prostate out at the same time? So what boiled down for me was that I needed to, I decided that what I would do is I would have the surgery. But the surgery, here we are, I'm given this option in September, and I don't have the surgery until January this year.
Yeah,
so I
That's
had to have surgery on January 10th. It's a long time. Because what they do, and you say, well, gee, why don't they just go in there and get rid of that cancer? Yank it out. Well, I was very concerned. I did a little bit of reading on it and found out that what they do is they like to basically, they like to go in and give you radiation and chemo for the rectal cancer. And since I had had the hormone therapy for the prostate, they consider that the prostate is kind of held at bay.
Yes.
We've reduced it. This treatment, when you get the shot, lasts for like 6 months. So I've got a pretty long window before I have to jump in and deal with the prostate. And so So what the heck? I went through radiation and chemotherapy. My chemotherapy was done by just taken orally. The radiation was a tough part for me. And again, Jerry, your explanation, I think yours is a little bit more sophisticated than mine.
Yeah.
But I had to go through must have been it was about 8 to 10 weeks of radiation. And what they would do is they would go in very pin, you know, they did the marker,
mm-hmm.
They put the little dot there, whatever. But they did every week I had it. They would go in and take a look and make sure that they did CAT scans and all that, and it was on target. So I felt pretty good about that. I did suffer some effects towards the end of it, but overall I hung in there pretty good. So for October, November, I'm getting radiation and chemo. Chemo, very little effect from it. It basically was a kind of chemotherapy that was not concentrating on the rectal part.
It was different,
rather than trying to chemotherapy throughout your whole body. So after all of that, what you got to do is you got to then another month, the month of December, I'm spending basically recovering from the radiation and chemo. And then in January, I go in for an operation that lasts 9.5 hours.
Amazing.
To take both of them out. Yeah, it was, what the amazing part about it is that my doctor, my rectal surgeon, who was a great guy, said, well, I think we can get you out of here in 3 days. And I said, yikes, 3 days? You spent in the hospital? I ended up spending 4 days.
Yeah.
And the good news was that I learned that not only do they take the cancer out, but they're in there to take a look to see if there's any evidence that it's spread. And the good news is that they were able to find out that it hadn't. So I get all done with that, and then I know that my next thing is I got to take a look at what I'm going to do after the fact. Once I have the surgery done, well, the prostate, I've seen my doctor a couple times, and it all turned out to be very, very successful for me. The symptoms that typically you hear of incontinence and all that, I was just amazed about the fact that, and again, as we pointed out with the previous show we did on this, is that getting a good doctor, getting the right urologist and one that's skillful and knows what to do and reconnect you as you get the prostate taken out is critically
important.
That's a big
job.
So it is. It's sort of like trying to take a battery out of a car that's in a bad spot. You can see it. You think it'd be pretty easy, but sometimes it's quite difficult. And so within days, I was able to basically regain full control of my urinary function.
Yes, and you only had a catheter
for
what?
I felt really good.
2 weeks?
I had a catheter for 2 weeks, and then once they yanked the catheter out, I was basically in pretty good shape within probably 4 or 5 days, where, depends became a history for me rather than a part of my life.
Right.
So that all worked out very well. But, I have to recover from the surgery, and then what I'm doing is I'm getting radiation. It's sort of a precautionary radiation. It's very standard after you've had rectal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The follow-up, because there's always some sneaky cells that could potentially get out. So I'm right now in the midst of I've had 4 treatments out of 10. So I'm getting every other week I go into the hospital.
Chemo.
And I'm amazed for my chemo.
Yeah.
And this is what's really amazing to me in terms of taking a look at what's happened in terms of treatment, because I can compare what my wife went through. My wife had esophageal cancer back in 1997, 98. And another thing we should point out, she was like stage four. So, and quite often you hear, well, you're not going to get operated on for your cancer. Oh, you're lucky. You have to go through chemo and radiation. Well, the bottom line is that if
surgery
is usually considered for stage one and two. So, the fact that you're not getting surgery is not necessarily good or bad. I don't like to cast any specific words on it. But so my wife was on a clinical trial for radiation and chemotherapy. And the fact is that she was giving a rather harsh clinical trial. And what was amazing about it was she was going to stay in the hospital for a week with respect to chemotherapy. For 5 days, she's going to get chemotherapy with radiation, stay in the hospital, and then take a couple weeks off and then go back in for 5 days. Well, her treatment was so harsh, and they really didn't know exactly, since she's on clinical trial, about those 5 days that she was in the hospital ended up being 5 weeks.
Wow.
She spent 5 weeks because her reaction to the chemo was so... So they were using a chemo cocktail. In other words, they were trying different combination of drugs, very powerful chemo drugs. And she was suffering all the effects you hear about, you know, loss of hair. Her mouth was just extremely painful with sores. And so she gets through the 5 days, and the doctors say to her, you were going to have to stop your treatment. Here we're told that this is your means by which you're going to be able to survive. And by the way, the treatment that we think you can survive with, you can't take anymore.
Right.
So it's not exactly in a good position. And so what she did is, and they said, well, can't you continue the treatment? And they said, well, if we continue the treatment, you will die for sure. Which kind of gives you a perspective as to the way that cancer was approached back then than it is now. Back then, the idea was, we're going to bring you to death's doorstep with chemo, because that will basically get rid of the chemo. And unfortunately, it'll kind of put you in a bad spot in terms of, you know, how you feel, et cetera.
Really, and other health problems will come along.
And then bring you back to life, and you will be better.
Yeah.
Well, so the good news for my wife, and as we went through it, was that she continued the radiation treatment, and she was able to live another 9 years, because the good news is that the treatment she got was so drastic, it did kill the cancer. Most of it, at least. As far as we can tell, it never came back. But the bad news is that the treatment, primarily the radiation, resulted in her, having symptoms, adverse symptoms of that. She had trouble breathing because the lining of her lungs was so damaged by radiation, and water was in it, and as they tried to treat that... She had trouble breathing. She had trouble swallowing because her esophagus had been beat up so much by radiation. So it was a tough road. But the good news is that out of all of that, she probably got herself eight and a half out of 9 years of that were pretty good life. She didn't really suffer. The quality didn't really decrease until till the bitter end.
Right.
So as we take a look at this, what we see is that we are finding that that when you compare radiation and chemo as it now versus 20 years ago when my wife had it, we find out that the approaches are much more gentler with the delivery and the sensitivity of symptoms. And
accuracy.
So my situation right now, in accuracy in terms of radiation, is very good. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the chemo with me because
you've got a very interesting delivery thing on your chemo. When I heard about it,
my delivery
sounded great.
Is,
I mean, it's no picnic, of course.
Yeah,
but.
No, it isn't. My chemotherapy is being delivered in two different ways. I go in every other week in the middle of the week. I spend a good size of the morning getting there about 8 o'clock and probably get done about 1. Now, there's a 4 or 5 hour window there of which I'm really only getting chemotherapy for about an hour and a half of that. Because you see, before I start my chemotherapy, they give me blood tests to see exactly where I stand in terms of my blood levels, in terms of white cells, and their ability to you know, because one of the symptoms of, or one of the effects of it is that it can reduce your blood cell countdown to the, where you're going to be more susceptible to getting infection, etc. So they're doing all the tests, and to give you an example, and in addition to the fact, they're talking to me about what are your symptoms. Now, with mine, the critical symptoms, the ones I am experiencing, are what's called neuropathy, which is a numbness. And it's a numbness that takes place in my hands, and it also takes place in my mouth. It could take place in my feet, but it's mostly in my hands that I feel it. when I am subjected to cool or cold weather. So when I had my first, and I ride my bike back and forth, it's about 6 blocks to get my treatment. So the first time I'm coming out of my treatment, all of a sudden, yikes, my wind hits me in the face. And here it's, you know, we're talking April in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I can feel it. It almost feels like I'm at the dentist office, and I've got I've taken the what is the
Novocaine.
Stuff you take to numb your
Novocaine.
Yeah. It feels like I've got Novocaine from the outside
right,
in.
Right, right, right.
It feels like
little bitty pinpricks.
It's funny, little pinpricks. But that was it. So what they did is every time I go in, they say, now, you know, I have every 2 weeks, so I have a week off to allow these symptoms to decrease. But I, so they also ask you how you're feeling.
Sure.
And the bottom line is that based upon that feedback, they then will adjust. So they have done a little bit of adjusting on mine. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is I took a look. Every time I get it, they give me a list of all the stuff I took. I take a look at the long list and say, wait a minute. They're giving me like 7 different things, but only 2 of them are chemotherapy.
Right.
Well, before I even start the chemo, what they'll do is they will then give me anti-nausea.
Right, pre-meds.
They give me a lot of liquids and stuff, this and that. So they're basically prepping you to make the symptoms less harmful or less harsh, which is, I find, the difference based upon the way it used to be done.
Oh, wow, that's huge.
So it's a big difference, because yesterday is a good example. The other thing that happens is that I mentioned my wife had a chemo cocktail.
Right.
Well, what they do for me is they give me one that takes about an hour and a half chemo drug. It's called oxyplatin, and that's the one I get the symptoms with the numbness. And then what they do is they then set me up with a pump that I wear with a port to put the drugs in, which I'm using a port, which is it's a simple way of having to not constantly puncture you. So that you get infections, they give you one spot where you can just kind of plug in and give you. And it also then concentrates exactly where they want the stuff to go.
Your aorta.
Because inside the port, it goes right into the bloodstream and works very effectively.
Yeah, it's subdermal too. It doesn't stick out. That's nice.
Another
improvement.
You can feel a little bit, but it's pretty, you know, you don't really notice it that much. But the bottom line is that, so what they do is they hook me up with this pump, so that I'm getting my FU5 chemotherapy. And both of these, by the way, one of them, to show you in terms of treatment, these drugs have been patented in the 60s and 70s. So the bottom line is, we're not talking about with chemotherapy coming up. Some of it is new drugs, but most of it is using traditional drugs in a much more gentle fashion,
in
a more effective way.
Ways.
That is what's more important. So I'm getting on a pump. I wear a pump for 40 hours and go back in and get unplugged. So this last week, I got unplugged at 11 o'clock. I was feeling a little bit of the symptoms of my neuropathy numbness, but within 2 hours, I'm at Wrigley Field watching the Cubs play the Yankees. Bundled up like a monkey. But the good news is I survived. I got through the whole game with minimal, because I think I took the precautionary measures of wearing 4 layers of gloves. I had a ski mask. So thank God I didn't go try to get some cash before I went to the ball game and go into a bank, because I would have been arrested in a heartbeat with a mask on. But the bottom line is that I'm able to function. Believe me, maybe I shouldn't. But
knock
on
wood.
4 weeks in, and they say that usually you're going to feel the effects. It isn't too accumulative. You're going to feel what you're going to get usually within the first 2 or 3 weeks. And so far I've been able to do very well. And so I guess what we are doing is we're demonstrating that there's through our treatments and our experiences that what you hear out there is the fact that that, you know, cancer is the aggressive approaches, the old approaches to try to that are hard to tolerate have been reduced, and now we're dealing with same treatments, but much, much better.
Same
delivery.
Drugs, but different treatments.
Same drugs, and but it's amazing how just a couple of days ago, the director of the Silence of the Lambs, a guy that by the name of Jonathan Demi, passed away, And I looked at his obit, and it said he had esophageal cancer, and he died from complications from esophageal cancer, which means that he didn't die from esophageal cancer. He died from the treatment.
That's right.
Which is exactly what happened to my wife. And so what's happening is that, you know, as we get these treatments, doctors and the research people realize that we've got to concentrate on making sure that the treatment doesn't kill the cancer.
Yeah.
You know, you might beat the cancer, but we also got to work on making sure that we beat the treatment.
That's right.
And that's where I think the advances have come so far.
Yes.
And it's really good.
Yes.
And so as we take a look at this, we've talked about treatment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mentioned to you the National, now we'll talk a little bit about the business of cancer. The National Cancer Institute, it's been established back in 1937. That's the one where I've cited a lot of my numbers. But as we grew up, really, we were taught, you know, and we take a look at this National Cancer Institute, it really had a big highlight. They're part of the government.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of the, you know, Department of Health. They, through the Cancer Act of 1971, is where we really started punching and pushing a lot of money into them, to the point that right now they've got a budget of about $5 billion, of which they're using 75% of that to dish out to do research by way of grants to other organizations, whether they be research hospitals, pharmaceuticals, other nonprofits such as the American Cancer Society. So the fact is that we've got a lot. The cancer is a very big business.
Oh yeah,
as I pointed out, and as we know, cancer, the cure for cancer is not the same as treatment. So, why is there this mindset, particularly back when we were kids, we were always hearing within our lifetimes there will be a cure
That's
for
right.
cancer.
That was the line.
Why do we have this perspective? And Jerry, I think we talked a little bit about it, but about back in the 50s, what was happening in terms of the illnesses that we were more concerned about. We're boomers. So
yeah.
We remember back when was the big thing that kids had to worry about getting?
What lung cancer, smoking.
Well, polio.
Oh, I forgot about polio. Yeah. Polio. Absolutely.
So what happened was that back in, when we were young, very young, you know, the concern was whether you're going to get polio. Well, all of a sudden, around the corner, we get this magic bullet by a doctor named Dr. Jonas Salk, where we can get vaccinations as children, and all of a sudden we don't have to worry about polio
anymore.
That's
our mindset now for cancer. That's what we went into it with.
So we were staged to believe that there's a magic bullet for cancer.
Right.
There is no magic bullet for cancer.
Isn't.
Cancer is much more complicated. There's too many types of cancer out there. You're not dealing with just one specific disease here. We're dealing with a myriad of diseases. So our mindset at this point, you know, like, and I'm sure you're, you know, my recollections are when we got the vaccinations back in the mid-50s to get rid of it. You know, it was kind of it was controversial,
it was,
needless to say. But still, the end result was, so in 1971, when we had the Cancer Act really get punched up with a lot of, National Cancer Institute get punched up with a lot of money, the thoughts were cure.
Yes.
We're going to get cured.
Well, they're still talking that way.
They still do, and there's no doubt, and there are a lot of people that feel that's the point.
Yeah.
So
it's easy to get cynical about this.
It is. In fact, you could go down a dark road very easily, but that's
not our
purpose
thing.
Here. Our purpose is to give the good result. So, but when you start talking about $5 billion, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, guess what's fitting in here now? All of a sudden, that money.
That's right.
So what we have here is we have research organizations that have an incentive, part of what they're doing is they want to get grant money so that they can continue on. And they are giving us accurate information, but we do know that it's important if they're going to continue to get money, these organizations, they need to put a positive spin. They got to put their best foot forward, and it helps because whether you're talking about treatment or cure, and typically we're talking about treatment with respect to these research organizations.
Right.
They want to, they know that their results can, we're going to lead to their ability to get more money, which helps them with respect to the research.
Right.
But, you know, there's also another, this is just like business.
Oh, it is business.
You know, it is. It's, they got to have a bottom line. They've got to be able to survive, to continue to do that. And it's amazing, the as you take a look at some of these, the way that these things progress, all of a sudden you have a budding pharmaceutical might be working on a cure. They get good results, and all of a sudden they become a buyout candidate.
That's correct.
Gee, this is beginning to sound a little bit like a startup.
Yeah, like a tech startup.
You know, like you'd have in a regular business.
Yeah, tech startup, like Silicon Valley.
It's not putting up a negative aspect. It's just explaining that there's a business here. And the other thing is that since the National Cancer Institute is a governmental part of the government, the solution to cancer quite often by politicians is to throw money at it. And we know that money, there's much more here than money. And so, we know that that people, you know, the way that we address it, this and that. So, you know, I'm a little bit older, and I'm 70, Jerry's 68.
Two years and an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I was reluctant.
It was so close.
I held off.
Yeah, you were a little stubborn, man. I don't know. Some things just don't change. The fact is that you can't. My demographics lead me to watching TV that's more for the older people, and sure enough, you're going to get ads that are going to, you know, which are good because they make you aware of cancer and other types of illnesses. And this is not only for in terms of treatments with research, but it's also hospitals.
Yes.
You find Cancer Centers of America is the big one.
Oh, yeah.
That you can go in. So there's a lot of been increase in spending on advertising. Mm-hmm. And I want to give you an example with this immunotherapy that I ran into. When you see ads for like treatment, you normally see them for other illnesses, and all of a sudden I'm hit with one for cancer, and I thought, geez, this is interesting.
Yeah, you don't see that all the time.
It was for, and what it was Bristol Myers was Opdivo, O-B-D-I-V-O, D-I-V-O, Opdivo. It's a drug that
a little different.
Is using immunotherapy. It's a little different. And you have to understand that, again, this is an example where you can't tackle these things in big. You've got to deal with a very specific cancer.
Right.
So Bristol Myers was able to, and worked very hard, close with the Food and Drug Administration so that they wanted to, you know, proactively make sure that they could, as soon as they could, once the testing was all done, get this drug out on the street to help people. And they're specific, to show you how specific it was, they were dealing within their clinical trials people that had stage 4 lung cancer that had already been treated for chemotherapy, and this is sort of like the immunotherapy was going to be the drug of last resort.
Last
so
pitch.
What they did... Hey, good news, 2015, the clinical trial comes through. We see that we're able to extend the life of these patients who are basically on, you know, just a step away from death and able to increase their life to some extent. Now, this is a good example of where don't go with the averages, the five-year, you know, thing.
This is a
survival
really
rate.
Good example of that.
This one, the amount, you know, when I mentioned to Jerry, I said, Jerry, guess how long? They, on an average, they were able to extend life 3 months.
Right.
3 months. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't some people in that group that were, you know, going much, much longer than that. But it was positive enough that what they did is they this was considered a successful treatment for people that were basically looking for their last resort in terms of treatment. Now, what they wanted to do at that point was Bristol Myers says, well, look, let's start doing that with people who haven't had chemotherapy.
Right.
Let's start it as if this is the first drug. 2016 didn't work.
Wow.
They didn't have any much better results with their chemo versus using immunotherapy. So this is just an example of a treatment that is, you know, right now in its, hopefully it'll you know, it's got a long ways to go. It's not something which is going to be used for a lot of different cancers currently or probably in the next couple of years, but it's got some potential. The most amazing thing on the business side of this, though, is the fact that Bristol-Myers is now advertising it, because you see they put a lot of money into this. Yep. So they're looking for, they need to get some, they need to get some money back in terms of their drug. So you can go on TV now and they are advertising this drug, as correctly so, that it will extend your life. They don't talk about in terms of how long, and they mention it's after chemotherapy. So basically, they're basically pitching the first trial, the first one that was successful. Right. And that's all they can do. And
it's not so bad, though. I mean, it's not like it's 3 months.
It's not bad.
It's sometimes 3-4 years.
It could be. It could be a lot longer. And it's but it's just amazing as you look in it. You see an ad. And you see, you know, a grandfather taking his kid to the baseball game, you know, mm-hmm. because he can do that now because he's lived a little bit longer. He's got quality of life. But the fact is that, you know, it's good. But it's interesting when you look in the background as to how that all shakes out. So what we've done here is tried to demonstrate that the fact is that most of the progress in terms of the being able to decrease the death rate has not been from cure, nope. although, like Jerry's mentioned, we've seen that that's still out there, and there are people that are pitching and working hard in that regard. But a greater effort has been done on the administration, the delivery of, you know, chemotherapy, radiation, and other types of things, hormone therapy, you name it. And so, but I think what we need to finish up, and as we take a look at this, to keep people in mind is that you are a unique individual with a unique cancer or whatever illness it is, disease, and your emotional state and the way that you approach it in terms of understanding it and learning about it is going to be a significant part of what is going to allow you to survive and to recover from your challenges of cancer.
Yes.
So, Jerry,
you are,
I think...
Absolutely.
It's amazing how, you know, what we've done is we've used our this podcast as a means. It's amazing what it started out with was that here we are, two brothers who we felt were so different.
Yep.
Because and what we realized as we had this common thing, challenge called cancer, and as we did it, we realized that there wasn't that much difference in terms of what we really think and what we do.
Yeah, how we operate. We've never really worked together this closely as adults.
He's a programmer, a very structured or system analyst. I am a CPA. So we have this very logical approach and very systemized way we address problems. And the other thing we found out is that we have some things which were very common that we enjoy, such as film.
Oh, yeah.
And I am a baseball enthusiast, or I've been called a lot worse than that.
That's a good one, John.
Some people say I'm obsessed with baseball.
No,
I like to say that it's my passion.
Oh, my. Yes.
And by the way, we need to understand that everybody needs a passion, because we all have challenges in life.
Yes, not just cancer. So, there's other stuff, too.
Yeah. It's just so the point being, and Jerry is more into... to the political scene,
right.
And we both have a common interest in films. So what we've done is we've done we learned that we're talking about cancer, but then we're mostly talking about all this other stuff. So we said, what the heck? We're talking about it. Let's, you know, get it out in the open. So we started our podcast with that in mind. And what's happened? It's become a big part of our therapy.
Big part.
As we, you know, go through this.
Oh,
big,
yeah.
Gigantic.
Yeah, I would have never expected it. Either did you.
No. You know, we didn't expect to be talking to each other as much as we are, and we look forward to it.
Yeah, it's a thing.
And my mother, and our mother, who, you know, she's 95 years old, she'll say, well, gee, it's so good you're doing this because you seem to be helping Jerry, and I'm sure Jerry's getting the other side of it and saying, well, gee, it's good you're doing this, you're helping John.
Yeah.
Well, we're helping each other, what can
I say? Yeah, that's mom. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a mom.
Yeah, that definitely. She's well. The good thing. It's funny, you know. One of the things I think you have to do, just in closing, a couple things about attitude and approach and emotions and all that stuff. One of the things you have to do is you do have to kind of hunt for the upsides, and you know, doing that is not a bad thing. Some people think it is. You know, you have this preconditioned kind of thinking that this is serious and somber, and your friends do too. They're not going to want to mention it. They're not going to want to talk to you, you know. And that's one of the reasons John and I talk so much, is because we can say anything about what's going on with us to the other person. Right. And we can't do that with other people because they're...
Well, you can talk to the other people about it, but you can only take it so far.
Oh, yeah, not very far
and
at all.
Talking to other people, it's amazing. Some of it you can't take very far at all. I mean, my favorite thing with respect to, when you talk to somebody and they say, well, how do you feel? Sometimes I hear that so much that cynically what I've done a couple of times, I've said, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. And the reason I don't know how come I don't feel is because I've, over this course of time, by the way, my treatment and everything is going to take from diagnosis to eventually getting done with it, in my cases, and in my short term, is a year.
Right.
So during that year, I've aged.
Sure.
I'm older. So I don't know.
What's what?
Because I don't know what my base point is. I don't know my base point because I'm older, I have cancer, and I've gone through a treatment. I don't know. Now, what's my baseline? How am I supposed to feel?
Yeah.
I can't go say how I felt before.
How do I feel? I feel like strangling
because
you.
That's yeah.
That's how I feel. Or anything I can do to help, just let me know.
Yeah, well, that's another one.
Oh, I got a call. I got to take
fact,
a call.
In fact,
see you later.
Yeah, well, it's the point that I'm very sensitive now. When I run into somebody who needs help, I said, I had to be truthful with you. I don't want to say, what can I do to help you? Because it sounds so
bullshitty.
Common. It is.
It's not meant to be bullshitty, but the problem is that when you call them up and ask them for help, they can't do it. So that's the experience. And I'm not weird about it or anything like that, because I've probably been that guy too. You know, it's just the weirdness that happens with all this. And so my advice to everyone is get a buddy. John and I found buddies.
What you've got to do is you've got to be able to identify the people, and it's pretty obvious. This is not what you call a difficult thing, but you know the people that will step
forward,
the ones that are close to you.
You really do.
And what you do is you just kind of act, give the perfunctory thank you so much, I'll keep that in mind, to the others. And
encourage them to buy a T-shirt.
And that's important.
Yeah,
that sounds like a good idea.
You know how you can help? Here's how you can help. Shirt.thebro.show. Get yourself one of these T-shirts.
Yes.
And goes to Jerry's Cancer Fund, since he has a deductible and copay to cover. So that'd be great.
Yeah, that's a whole other issue in terms of this. And that's dealing with the whole insurance, et cetera.
It's not going to get better.
Right now, of course. Yeah, that'll be part of our fake news.
Yes,
coming up soon.
Really, go get yourself a T-shirt. People say, I already got a T-shirt. No. You can't have too many T-shirts, number one. Number two, you're going to do a little advertising for a good thing. Because it's summer's coming up. You know, you can display proudly. We've got the best fist bump on this T-shirt you've ever seen. It's really cool looking.
Yeah.
It's graphically nice. And we've got like a Blood Brother thing going on with it too. Like the knuckles are red and the rest of it's like neon blue. Aren't they cool, John? You've seen them.
Hey, I've got one on and I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
It's in fact, it's amazing how when I wear my T-shirt out and people really are impressed by the design and ask questions. It's fun. I enjoy it. I enjoy wearing it.
Yeah, I do too. I wear my old friend Mary Jane. So that's it. Yeah.
This is about it. I know it's a little off the beaten track of what we normally do, but we just felt the need to jump back in and talk about it. So it's been a good session, Jerry. And
thank you, John.
And so quite all right. And have a good day.
All right. You too.